When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, the guy who made Toronto the Good a little bit more mischievous, the godfather of punk here in the city, Gary Topp, concert promoter. And the guy who brought punk to Toronto. We'll talk about more of that in 1 second. First, if you want to get in touch with the show, head over to the email address, turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do for the show. And he will get the message to me. You can find me on Instagram at Left4Damian. There is a Turned Out of Punk TikTok page, a YouTube page, an Instagram page, and a Facebook page. All of those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. And we post videos on there and edits and stuff that I make for this podcast and stuff like that. But once again, you don't need to see that stuff if you don't want to. You just listen to this podcast right here each and every week. And if you want to support this podcast, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that we are doing here. When I say we, I'm not just being, you know, a little egomaniacal with that. I mean, Tristan as well. You know, the two of us work hard on this thing. So let people know if you enjoy it. You can also check out the band I play in. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. We have a show in Yellowknife coming up at the end of the month. And then we have a show in Montreal in November. And that's it. So see you around if you're there. Puzzlefest. I'm excited to get to finally play Puzzlefest. So we're doing that this year. We also have a brand new 7-inch on the venerable Sub Pop Records coming out. And we got some other stuff. There's still copies of Another Day and One Day. And Someday, I think those are the days that we have available right now. And you can find those over at fuckedup.cc as well. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, the guy who brought punk rock to the city, Gary Topp, is on the show today. And when I say the city, I mean the city of Toronto. Gary is one of those people that you just ask anybody who was involved in the scene early on, who the godfather of this thing is and was, it's Gary Topp. He brought the Ramones here for the first Ramones show ever, brought the Screamers here, brought the Misfits here, like early on, like he's bringing these bands up here and we talk about all of it. It's a really fun conversation with someone who's spent their life in rock and roll. And you don't have to just take my word for it because there is a brand new book from the incredible publishers over at UXB Press called He Hijacked My Brain. That is a memoir of Gary Topp, but more a kind of like a memoir of the city and a look at the city. It's an oral history. There's lots of other voices in this thing. There's great pictures in this thing, and it is really worth your time to read it. I promise you, if you're at all interested in the history of music, but specifically the history of music in Canada and definitely the music history in Toronto, this thing is invaluable. And I will say this because we've had UXB people on, Derek, every single time they put out a book, because they are a publisher that is right up my alley in terms of the stuff they're putting out. You're too late to pick up a copy of Tomorrow Is Too Late, their history of hardcore in Toronto, but you can still pick up the fantastic Eve of Darkness, the Toronto Metal in the 80s book that they've put out, as well as He Hijacked My Brain over at UXBPressCanada.bigcartel.com. There's a U.S. site, too, they have. Go over there. You can find out all this information as well. I'm not going to ramble on too long for you right here. There's not too much more for me to add. Pick up those books and sit back, relax, and enjoy Gary Topp on Turned Out of Punk. Gary, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I feel like I've waited a very long time to get to ask you some of these questions. And, you know, the book's phenomenal. Like, I think, you know, they did a really great job at kind of your story is being kind of illustrated out with all these other people, all these other voices. But I feel like there's several books within your life. So I feel like we will have an episode that will be a great addendum to the book.
Well, this is number two. The first was a graphic novel.
Well, that's right. There, I do remember there's a graphic novel. Yeah, that's right. Oh. So, well, I feel like maybe there's probably a third or fourth or fifth or multiple volumes, and let this be maybe the start of a new one. I got to start off, though, the way they all start off. When to you was the first time you heard about punk or kind of felt that there was a genre called punk happening?
I had had a subscription to the Village Voice since around 1960. And I sold them. I gave them away, actually, about 10 years ago when we were moving. But so I had, when I was a teenager, I was following the jazz, in New York, and the folk music scene, and continued. So I was reading about all these bands playing at CBGB. This is like sort of the more current punk era, right when it started. So I kind of knew all about it. I think the first time I ever heard it mentioned was Suicide were considered punks before they recorded and were famous.
Well, because you mentioned it there, you were into music from like a real young age and going to shows from like a really young age, right?
Yeah, I was into music from, I'll say day one, but maybe like 4 or 5 years old. I had a record player in my bedroom. It was on the floor in a big wooden console or whatever. And I'd play records and I'd sit on the floor next to the record player. They were like 78s pretty much. And I'd bang my head against the wall. I always tell people I was the first headbanger. I mean, I just had this rhythm. And I used to listen to the radio in bed. And how I fell asleep was actually lying on my stomach, head face down in the pillow, hands stretched under the pillow and down the side of the bed, the front of the bed. And I'd shake myself to sleep or sing songs. Singing, you know, falling asleep doing that. And so I was really into music. I used to listen to the radio a lot. In the earliest days, I remember grade one, grade two, I had my tonsils out. And so I was at home a bit and I would be listening to the radio and I'm listening to CBC and they'd be having all these people having discussions like we are today. And then they'd say, now here's Frank Sinatra or somebody. With one song, and I always thought that they played on stage. There was like there's millions of musicians sitting in the audience waiting to go up and sing their songs. So, and then my parents kind of were very interested in music, and I guess the first sort of genre that I ever followed and appreciated was the old Broadway shows from like the 50s. And then, when rock and roll kind of started with Elvis and all that, my parents actually took me, probably because they didn't get a babysitter, but they took me to see Bill Haley and the Comets at Maple Leaf Gardens. And at one point, I years ago, I was kind of investigating that if there were any ads for it or whatever. And it was supposedly the first rock concert in at Maple Leaf Gardens. So, I really was into music. I loved it. Had a little drum kit. Used to play along with the records. Then when I had my bar mitzvah, some cousins, my aunt and uncle from Montreal, who were quite rich, they owned a collection agency, an international collection agency. Just off the top, when I first time I went to Europe, I stayed in their apartment with some friends. They weren't there. And on the way down in the old little elevator, Andrew Lou Goldham was coming up, was
Oh my.
getting into the elevator when we got in. This is like in the, late about 1968. But anyway, I got this woolen sack tape recorder for my bar mitzvah present. It was amazing. And I used to, I don't know if you remember, you're old enough to know about those Martian records that they used to put where they tell a story and then they put little clips of the songs like, there's Elvis, what's she saying? Don't step on my blue suede shoes, that kind of thing, right? And I
Yeah.
used to make those things on my tape recorder and record them with a mic off my record player and take the clips and take them down to Chum AM, hoping that they would play them, which they never did. I thought they were pretty good. And in the day, in the 60s, my parents had, like everybody's, a hi-fi. And CBC TV was found around 88.1, where CKLN used to be on the left of the dial. And my dad hooked up the tape recorder into the stereo FM. And whenever anybody that I wanted to see on Ed Sullivan, I would tape it and all that. I had an amazing collection of all that, especially the Rolling Stones. I mean, they were my kind of favorite band back in my teen days.
What was it about the Rolling Stones over, like, say, the Beatles, I guess would have been the more fan favorite around that time, I guess.
Well, the Rolling Stones were punk rock, I mean, or punk blues rock. And I did f follow everything that Andrew Lou Goldham did with that band. I owe a lot of my, I don't know if it's creativity or talent or whatever, but I owe a lot to him because I watched closely how he promoted the Rolling Stones. Like, I came out of folk music, so, and it was getting pretty corny, but folk music, you're learning about blues and first time I heard the Rolling Stones, I was in a girl's backyard studying for an exam. That's like quotation marks around that, you can't see that, but and the radio, the transistor radio was on, and Not Fade Away came on. I said, holy fuck, what is that? And I was a huge fan of Buddy Holly from, when he was popular. I had a lot of his records, and it was, I wanted to kill myself when he died. It's just tragic. But so I knew the song Not Fade Away, but hearing the Stones do it, I'd never heard anything like it before because there hadn't been really anything like it. And I just got right into them. No, at one point when I was in high school in a trigonometry class, this is when I think it was Let's Spend the Night Together. Can't remember it right now at the moment, but the Chum AM publicly said they would not play the Rolling Stones because of their filthy habits and all the controversy that went around with them, the drugs and the peeing behind gas stations and all this shit and, fucking young girls and whatever. And I wrote a letter to Chum, which is in the book, complaining why they wouldn't play the Rolling Stones, and they would play the Platters, who had been busted for drugs, and they played the Fendermen, the Bird Is the Word, and P.J. Proby with his ponytail, and Dean Martin, who's an alcoholic supposedly, and all this, but they wouldn't play the Rolling Stones. And I actually got a letter back from Alan Waters, who was, I can't remember, but a director or something there, and saying when they cleaned up their act, they would start playing them. Alan Waters, by the way, was Gary's, no, not Alan Waters, sorry, Alan Slate,
Oh,
who was Gary Slate's father, and Gary Slate ran Q107.
yeah, that's
I don't think he likes when I talk about that letter. Must be pretty embarrassing.
it's funny how threatening the Rolling Stones were. Like, obviously now it's just part of pop culture canon, but my mom was at the show in Montreal, and there was like a riot that broke out, and Mick Jagger threw a chair at a DJ or something, and it was
It was
like,
like, yeah, go on.
I was just gonna say it was a scary thing for, I guess, society at that time.
Well, it was, imagine them going to a punk show or the Sex Pistols or whatever. That's what it was like. At one of the shows, David Marsden, who at the time was Dave Mickey, who was like, fast talking, AM DJ, and the biggest thing in Toronto at the time, and drove a pink Cadillac and all. He was emceeing the show, and in those days, the seats were not fastened to the floor. And he got up at the before the show started and asked everybody to move closer to the stage, which kind of, got a little touchy because it wasn't, I mean, the Rolling Stones never filled the place. I think they did like 9,000 people in the first time, and 11,000, and maybe 13,000. I was lucky enough to be, I was a member of their Rolling Stone fan club in Canada or Ontario, and so I always used to get great seats on the floor and once in the boxes. And this was like in 1965, and twice in 66. Frantic. And it was wild. I have an article from the Star that shows a picture. If you picture the ends of Maple Leaf Gardens, the goalie ends, and there used to be a wall there, and then people on top of the wall, and girl was dangling from the wall, and they had the fire department, whoever, was pulling her up and stuff. No, they were crazy shows. They were amazing. So, like, getting into punk rock, well, it didn't seem like anything to me because I had lived through all that.
Well, it's interesting because, like, as people have come on this show over the years, it seems like musicals, theatrical performance, and sort of like the Rolling Stones' take on, I guess, American blues are really foundational to punk rock. It's almost like that theatrical performance layered on top of really back to basics rock and roll is what kind of defines the genre early on. So it's
Yeah, I
interesting that,
think.
well, it's interesting that drew you in as a person, kind of, foundational to punk rock, certainly in this city.
Oh, I was totally into the stage show. The punk rock, the earliest punk groups in Toronto, they were very theatrical. Stephen Leckie was totally theatrical, they all were. The Dials were the only band I hated. They had a great rhythm section, but the singer was just too much. And he was like trying to be theatrical and putting it on, but I just didn't like it. But theatrics is very important to a performer on stage, totally. I mean,
Well, and it's also interesting you're bringing up all the, like, what you bring up the theatrics foundational to the early Toronto stuff. Like, You think about Nash the Slash too, and there was a theatricality to the stuff coming out of Toronto
Oh
early on.
yeah. Well, when I was running the original 99 Cent Roxy, I booked a few bands there on Friday midnights. It didn't really work because the stage was about 3 yards deep. So everybody had to kind of line up, the drummer in the middle and everybody to the side. But one band called Breathless, which were this incredible prog rock band that featured Nash, not as Nash the Slash, and he dressed in a tuxedo, a top hat, and blew fire and played violin and mandolin and very theatrical. And that's how I met him. And eventually he quit the band, and just around the time when Eno was splitting from Roxy Music and going on his own, Nash figured, why do I need a band? I should do this on my own. I have all the equipment, all the technical gear. And he went on his own, and I was with him when the name Nash the Slash was decided upon. We had a quite a laughing fit trying to think of different names for his persona, but we came up with Nash the Slap. One of them was Little Skippy Hitler and the Shower Romantics. It was either Room Antics or Romantics, and I think we almost each of us almost died laughing when, for some reason, that came up. We were high and whatever, and but he came up with now we came up with Nash the Slash. He took it from a Laurel and Hardy movie, and he was gonna be this one man band, and he composed a soundtrack to the Louis Buñuel Salvador Dalí film Un Chien Andalou, and we were gonna run it at, we ran it at the Roxy. And he was introduced as Nash the Slash, but we also promoted him as being as direct from Iceland. So that's how it kind of started with Nash. But yeah, theatrics were a big part. Theatrics, I think, were also, for me, and I guess I was pretty unusual as a promoter. But theatrics was what was the whole game in running venues, from personally DJing shows, not just throwing on a cassette, to whatever, got into our heads after smoking or doing drugs, whatever, and very theatrical goings on at every event. At the movie theater, and we tried to do that at concerts too. We weren't like the normal promoters, that walked around with a attaché case handcuffed to my wrist or any of that stuff. I mean, we were into the thing and into the event, and we wanted to make them events. So theatrics, you're right, I think, is very important. The punk groups. I mean, I kind of got bored. Sorry, I'm not insulting you because I think your group was good. But the 90s, after Nirvana and Teenage Fan Club sort of hit it big with bandwagon-esque, I thought everything was really going downhill. And the theatrics to me in those days were bands, in their shorts and jumping up and down and, that kind of stage presence that the bands had, and it got really kind of boring. But the punk shows in the earliest days, you didn't know what was going to happen on stage. You didn't know what would be said on stage. Stephen Leckie, Nazi Dog, for the Vileptones. I mean, there's reams of material of him just spouting off. It was incredible.
Yeah, it's such an amazing period of just explosion in music. And I realize now reading the book how much of my definition of punk is shaped by ultimately you guys, because of like the bands you guys booked. Like to me, the Necessaries are an incredible punk band, but reading the book, it's like, oh, because you guys booked the necessary, so that's why I was able to find the single when I was buying used singles. Or all the bands that would wind up on these flyers for the Horseshoe shows, where I'm like going through years later being like, oh my God, okay, I got to find a record by this band because they opened this show. And it is broad. And I think that's when punk is at its best, is when it's not like one thing, when it could be every single band that's on the last pogo, even the reggae bands.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had a ton of homemade garage cassettes of bands and singles and all that stuff. And when we were moving from a house to a condo about 10 years ago, we put everything in a locker on Dufferin Street. And 6 months later, I came back to get my record player because we had done a renovation and lived up north for 3 or 4 months while it was being done. And I came back and opened up the steel doors, and I see all this art that was like bleached. There had been a flood and nobody told us. And I lost like two boxes of local music. I mean, it just wasn't worth trying to fix. Couldn't afford to, or I don't even know if it would work. Like, the cassette tapes were like just a mess. So, but I have some CD compilations that I had made that I have made. And when you listen to the local Toronto bands, I knew they were as good as anybody else in the day. That's what I thought. I mean, we wouldn't have booked them. But you listen to them now and they stand up to anybody. And I think they stand up to, I mean, there were really, to me, only two other cities that were worthwhile thinking about: New York and London. London was very political. New York was very artistic. We had the best, we of all of both those locations, Toronto punk had so much variety, and the playing was great. They stand up, they sound just like fre they're fresh. There was a real drive, and the Toronto scene is really to be respected.
I think it's undervalued. I really do. Like, it's
Totally.
doing this podcast, like finding out that the Bad Brains were influenced by the Vile Tones, or,
Yeah.
just all these great, like you're saying, bands that were like Arson, like the Arson single, like the Xister single. Like, there's just so many great singles that are just completely forgotten. And that's not to mention all the bands that didn't really record, that were just on smash tapes, or just,
Yeah, yeah.
there was a rush of bands in the city, and it's just like such an exciting time to
Oh,
kind
it
of
was. Totally.
going back before that. You probably were going to shows and aware of like the Yorkville kind of thing as it was beginning to kind of come together. Like, do you remember when that? Because that's almost like, to me, the shift of Toronto the good to sort of the modern Toronto, or certainly Toronto the music city. Do you remember when
Yeah.
Yorkville started kind of coming together as a place to go?
Well, like I said, I was into music forever. So I go through the rock and roll phase. The first album I ever bought was Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps. And just look at them, right? They look contemporary. I wasn't really into the hippie movement. I like some of the music, but I wasn't at all a hippie. But out of my favorite band, and I guess in the 60s would have been the Stones and the Love and Spoonful. Still, I'm not a big Stones fan now, although I completely respect them. But Love and Spoonful to me are like one of the great groups of all time. And although they had like a million hits, they were complete hit makers. People don't remember them, but they came out of the folk music scene. Zoliannovsky, who lived in Toronto and was kind of a wayward folky, and I saw him a few times at a club on Avenue Road above Davenport called the Village Corner. And I knew, so I knew who he was. And at the Village Corner, one time there was a San Francisco bluesy, jug bandy kind of a musician that played there. His name was Jesse Fuller, and he lived in his not limousine, in his station wagon. And he was like a one-man band, you know, had the kick drum and the snare and the harmonica and the guitar, and played kind of jug bandy music. And the Lovin' Spoonful, I think, came out of that kind of scene, the jug band music scene, which was the folk music scene. I went to a lot of, I didn't walk around Yorkville like a hippie or anything. You know, there was a great bookstore there. There were some art galleries, but I went to the clubs. I specifically the folk music clubs were, which were really tiny little rooms. You know, I think maybe 60, 70 people tops, but I saw everybody that I wanted to see there, like all the you know, they were actual stars in the folk music scene, you know, for, I mean, maybe underground stars, but I saw everybody that I wanted to see there. And then sort of through the getting into blues and everything, I got into jazz, and we used to go to jazz clubs. At that age, you couldn't go at night because of the drinking age limit, but you could go Saturday afternoons. Every Saturday afternoon, I was at a club, you know, listening to jazz for the matinee. And you know, there was the Town Tavern and the Colonial Tavern. Town Tavern was on Queen Street, right around the corner from Yonge, and then there was the Colonial Tavern on Yonge Street, and there was Le Coq d'Or, which I went to several times because I knew who, you know, Ronnie Hawkins was a big 50s star. And but they also had a lot of funk groups there. There was one group called the Jimmy Castor Bunch that I used to love going to see. And Jimmy Castor had this huge afro, made my hair in the six like nothing. But they were great. So I got a real grounding and lucky to be able to go to these clubs. Like I think it's in, I probably told it in the book, but one Saturday afternoon, my friends and I went to the Colonial and to see Thelonious Monk. Go to the matinee. I interview him for my school paper. He gave me a quote. One of the quotes they put on as the caption under the picture was, "The only cats worth anything are those who take chances," which a light bulb went off in my head when I heard that line. Interviewed him, got in the car, drove up to Huntsville, to Hidden Valley, the ski resort. This is in the summer though, and they used to have bands there, and the Yardbirds were playing there with Jimmy Page. So that's quite a day in the
What?
life of any kid. Yeah. And then we went to Algonquin Park hoping to find girls, you know?
Wait,
We didn't.
the Yardbirds were playing at a ski resort in Northern Ontario?
It was like in the summer, they used to run shows in the chalet. And it was like a floor and then a half a floor above with a hole in it, and you could look down onto the stage. Now it's two floors with no hole, but like a balcony almost. But oh, it was amazing. And they walked through the audience, you know. So I was very lucky. I was very lucky. And you know, although I did really shitty in high school, like I failed twice, went to summer school twice, all in like 4 years. And you know, my parents kind of didn't lock me with a key, but threw me in my bedroom to study. And all I did was study to do what I was meant to do, what the Lord gave.
The real studying.
Yeah, the real stuff. You know, I was listening to the radio and reading magazines and cutting out pictures and all sorts of stuff. I mean, I have like newspaper, I have magazine clippings. If you went to see that Bob Dylan movie, which I didn't like, well, there's a scene in it where he's sitting on the floor in the apartment, and he's surrounded on the floor with all these newspaper clippings, and magazine ads and stuff about him in the, when he was first surfacing. And I got a, I noticed a lot of the things that I have still. So I was very into it. My parents, they wanted me to do well. They actually bought me a five-string banjo at, from Gibson, the Gibson plant in Chicago, which I actually sold in 1980 for an ARP synthesizer. You can only pretend you're a racing car driver for so long before it gets boring. And it killed me. And then, just recently I saw that same banjo on Antiques Roadshow for like $6,000 or something.
Did you, when was the first time you saw Bob Dylan?
I was very lucky being at, in the right place at the right time. I didn't know anything about him. I used to go to New York a lot with my, they would take me and we'd go to clubs. And, you'd be outside on Bleecker or MacDougall or I'd just hanging around. And all these folk singers used would be walking around with their guitar cases, going to gigs or whatever. And I was out there one night and this black folk singer who used to come and play in Toronto all the time, named Len Chandler, was walking by, and I'd seen him several times. And I'm a precocious little kid, and awestruck seeing all these guys. They're your heroes or your whatever, your mentors, everything. And he walked by, and I ran up to him and, introduced myself to him. And like I'm about maybe 16 years old. And I go up to him and I introduce myself. And, yeah, I've seen you in Toronto a number of times. And, well, and we're talking. I said, is there any shows that anybody playing down here that you think I should see that I might not know about? And he said, go to Gerd's Folk City and see this kid that's opening for John Lee Hooker. His name's Bob Dylan. So my friend and I went and, that's like 1961. He hadn't even recorded. He was just pretty new to Toronto, to New York, rather. And he blew my mind. I've never not worn Levi's since seeing. Like, he was incredible and very rough and gruff. I don't know if you how much you know about him, if you've heard his earliest stuff, like his first album. Very rough, ragamuffin, rough and gruff, loose, like nobody had ever heard before. Nothing. Years later, many years later, it hit me that he in that first album, the one with his face on the cover and he's wearing his hat, was the Ramones of folk music. He like totally destroyed folk music. And actually, it's one of the reasons why I really don't like the Bob Dylan movie that's out now. Timothy's a good actor, but and I thought he did the electric stuff well, but the early stuff, he's too clean. He's like, Hollywood movie. It was just like really, he didn't capture what I saw and what I heard. And his voice, Dylan's voice in those days, one Sunday afternoon, I was blasting that album in my bedroom on my little record player. The windows were, I used to like opening the windows so everybody could hear what I was playing, the neighbors. And the neighbors complained about it and called the cops.
Oh my
And
God.
they came, the cops came and told me to turn it down. And said, I'm getting complaints about whatever you're playing, there's noise. So, Timothy does not, he learned how to sing, but he did not capture at all that just what every kid wanted to be. He's a real kind of punk, a country bluesy punk. And he wasn't much older. He may have been 19 years old.
And if you look at, the accepted fact that the Velvet Underground are proto-punk, who's the proto-punk to the proto-punk? It's Bob Dylan. Like, so there is, like, sort of this trajectory of, like, and it is like you're saying, there's something about it that's abrasive, and that's something about it that, like, the Rolling Stones would have been
confrontational at the time when it came out that, yeah, that movie does not capture, does not really get the edge of what that was at the time, I
Yeah.
imagine. What about the Minor Birds? Do you ever see them?
I saw them once. The Minor Bird Club was right next to the Purple Onion. I didn't see much rock in Yorkville. I used to like going to see the Stitch in Time at El Patio, and I like John Lee and the Checkmates, an R&B band, and the Rogues, who ended up being Mandela and so. But I was more into folk music. And by the time when Dylan came out, folk mu I had been listening to folk music for a number of years prior, in the late 50s, and the Weavers, for instance, and that Pete Seeger was in, and then the time that Dylan was sort of coming around, folk music was becoming very preppy and more theatrical, actually. Like they had their suits, and everybody, all the bands had a stand-up comedian in there while the bands were tuning up after every few songs and stuff. In fact, my parents took me once to New York. And we went to the Bitter End. My parents were pretty cool. And we went to the Bitter End, and there was this band called The Terriers playing there. And there's a picture of the ad in the book, but The Terriers, TARRIERS, in the late 50s, they had a big hit on the hit parade, the Banana Boat song, that song, day-o, 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 I want to go home, Harry Belafonte. They had a big hit with that. And the group was a guy named Eric Darling, Alan Arkin, the late actor, and another guy, Bob Carey. So we're going to the Terriers at the Bitter End, probably like 1961 or 1960. And it's a quartet. And in the band was the same guy from the old group, Bob Carey. There was a banjo player named Eric Weisberg. If you don't know Eric Weisberg, you certainly know the music in Deliverance. There was a string bass, a double bass player, Marshall Brickman. Marshall Brickman played banjo, mandolin, bass, and all that, and he was the stand-up comedian in the group when when they were tuning up. Marshall Brickman went on to do many records, but most recently he co-wrote Jersey Boys, and he ended up being a co-writer and producer on Woody Allen's earliest movies, Take the Money and Run and all those. And anyway,
They're the bassist in one of those bands in The Mighty Wind too, right? That film from a few years ago.
yeah, I mean, The Mighty Wind is about those corny folk singers that were coming out at the time of Peter, Paul and Mary and all that. But anyway, at the club, I went up to the band and I was talking to them, and said, "Would you come to Toronto?" And in high school, I booked my first show, being the Terriers, who played at a club on Church Street, which is now, oh, what's it called? It's a leather bar.
The Eagle? Is that the Eagle?
Yeah, the Eagle, just above college, just north of Maple Leaf Gardens on the east side of the street. Black Eagle or whatever they're called. And that was called the Fifth Peg, and it was a more club, more sort of higher grade folk club. But they played there for a week, came back and played there again, and then they were booked to play at what was called the world's largest hootenanny at Maple Leaf Gardens. They headlined, So they became quite a thing. So I got my start really early in doing all this. I was gung ho.
Did you mention smoking
Oh, can
and
I tell you another
oh,
story?
please,
Hey,
absolutely.
Eric Darling, who was in the first Terriers with Deo. One time, when I was in New York, I was in outside, and he walks by, and I loved him. I skipped out camp. I was a counselor and skipped out camp one night when the kids were asleep. I don't know how, why I did, and hitchhiked back into Toronto from Muskoka. It was a Boy Scout camp to see Eric Darling at the Purple Onion, and then got the late bus back to Muskoka, and didn't get caught. But the guy was incredible, and still, like, he's got an album called True Religion. It was brilliant. I see him on the street. I go up to him, talking, introducing myself again, and saw you at the Purple Onion, blah blah blah. And so, what are you doing? You got a new album coming out? And he had a very what's a tremolo kind of a high voice like that, right? Yeah. He says, "Yeah, I've got a new group. I got a new group, and the single's coming out next week." I said, "Oh, what's the group called?" He says, "The Rooftop Singers." Well, the Rooftop Singers is, the song "Walk, Walk Right In,"
Yeah.
and the singer and the 12-string guitar player on that. So, I had great experiences. I was really lucky, and at the right place at the right time. The other thing about then in New York, which really pissed me off in that Dylan movie, is that there's a scene where they're in, I think it's Cafe Wa, and it's like a little folk club, and they're applauding. They're applauding. Now, in those days, those clubs were in the basement, and people lived above them. And the thing was, you didn't clap, you clicked your fingers. And why they missed that in that movie as a bit of comic relief, as historical reference, I'll never understand. Pissed me off so much. Can't stand that movie now.
Well, you mentioned smoking a couple times now and like being involved in rock and roll. Did you know or ever have any run-ins with Canada's Prince of Hash, Rosie from Rochdale?
I wasn't really into Rochdale. I went there a few times for some movies that Reg Hart played. I wasn't a hippie, so I never really went there, and I got my pod elsewhere. I did go there one time, and probably I can't remember who I was getting it from, getting some pod from somebody. And when I'm leaving, I get into the elevator, and I'm going down. The elevator doors open, and there's like 10 cops walking into the elevator, walking into the I just fucking got out of there quick. But no, I smoked all through high school, which would have been in the late to mid early no early mid 60s, right through. I had an old football that was deflated, and the whatever you call it, the tube was split open, and I used to keep my pot in there where I hid it outside.
I think Rosie had a club too. I think it was called the Fillmore North that was around Toronto, or that was his production company at least. And they did Alice Cooper shows, maybe Alex Harvey band too.
The who? Alex Harvey?
Yeah, I think he did an Alex Harvey band show at some point.
I don't know. I kind of remember the name, but I'm not sure. But Alex Harvey, I'm a huge fan. At the Roxy, I used to play him all the time. And Manfred Mann and the Earth Band, who I didn't really care about. I like Manfred Mann and Paul Jones and all that, but not the Earth Band was a little too synthy for me. But they were playing at Con Hall one time, and Alex Harvey was supposed to play to open. And we go, and we're waiting for Alex Harvey, and the guy comes on stage and says Alex Harvey couldn't get through the border. So I want to introduce you to Rush, and they played instead of Alex Harvey. And I've never forgiven Rush to this day. Never. Actually, the only thing I ever liked by them was their version of Not Fade Away, which was a very early single they put out. But I cannot, I respect Rush, but I can't, oh, I can't listen to them. It just doesn't interest me. But that show, I'll never, to miss Alex Harvey, he's somebody I would have booked had he been alive.
Rush opened for the New York Dolls too in Toronto at that show,
Yeah, at
right?
the Victory.
Were you at that show?
No, because I was working. I had to work. Like, I didn't go out, from like 72 to like 1980, 81, when we closed the Edge. I worked every night. I would not, I trusted the people that worked for me, but or us, but I never trusted them enough not to be there. I had to be there, kind of not in checking the money or like, sitting by the till at a bar, but just making sure that we were, that everything, it was an event. I always was there, making sure the sound was right on the movies, everything, So I didn't go out much, but I did book a couple of shows at the Victory around that time when I was at the Roxy. Neither of them happened. One was Little Feat in
Awesome.
like 1973 or four when they were unknown. And 2 weeks before the show, they canceled and had split up for a while. And then they recorded Dixie Chicken, and the rest is history for them. And the other one was Little Richard, who canceled, called in the week before and canceled because he was sick and was in the hospital, supposedly. But so I never did anything there. But I used to go to the Victory Burlesque all the time in high school because it was great. You'd get a great jazz combo. You'd get a comedian who hosted the girls. You'd get the strippers, and you'd see a good movie.
That's a night of entertainment.
That was, yes, exactly. It was great.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
What about wheelchair? When Freddie Pompei was on the podcast, he said that he had a band with Peter, or no, he didn't say it. I think it's actually in the book, Treat Me Like Dirt. They talk about wheelchair, which is Freddie Pompei's band with Peter Aykroyd.
I kind of remember that happening, but I didn't know that. I didn't really know Freddie until the Vile
Did you get any inclination that there was a scene kind of ready to happen before that Ramones show that kind of, as in the book, they kind of talk about that being sort of the kickoff for everything?
I think I noticed that there was a scene happening at the Roxy. I think that group of people that ended up being in the music scene used to come to the Roxy. They dressed the part. They came to the certain, well, they came to sort of the more arty movies. They continued to come all the time. They followed me to the New Yorker. So I think it was starting then.
And like, who were the first bands that you remember in Toronto being like kind of on board with this new thing that was kind of popping off? Because there's like Zoom single, I guess. There's like stuff that kind of, I guess,
Yeah.
predates it. But like, what to you was like sort of the first Toronto punk band?
Well, when I think about it now, I think the Ugly Ducklings probably would have been, but no, I think I probably, the Vile and all these kids who used to come to the movies and then were starting bands, they Teenage Head was not from Toronto, but they as well. The earliest ones, I can't even remember.
How much awareness did you guys have of what was going on in Hamilton? Like, Teenage Head obviously becomes a part with the Toronto scene in a way, but like there's, I guess, Simply Saucer around then too, and sort of there's earlier stuff around there as well.
Well, I didn't really know much about Simply Saucer until a few years later, like, maybe 77. They used to play at the Horseshoe a lot, but they never drew. I think Teenage Head were the ones initially, like as far back as when the Ramones were happening, that I would have known about. I mean, they wanted to play to open for them, but we weren't like anybody else. I didn't really want to have another sort of punk or whatever kind of band opening for the Ramones at that particular show. To me, that was like a really heavy duty, groundbreaking show for me. And I wanted something completely different and chose Johnny Loveson, who I thought was more punk than everybody because he did it all solo.
Was that always important to you to kind of mix up the bills like that and not have to like a bill with every
Yeah.
single band sound the exact same?
I've always tried to book interesting support to the headliners, not your typical choices. I liked to be able to promote the opening acts in the same way as the headliners. We treated them the same. But I've always cared about what I booked. It wasn't just anybody. Had to be interesting. Maybe people didn't like it, but if I liked it, then that's all that counted. I mean, there were things like people couldn't believe we put John Otway opening for Public Image. Years or Hazel Atkins, and then years later saying, "Fuck, that was like a brilliant," I'm thinking differently than your average guy or musician or music fan. I take a lot of time to make those choices.
And I think it speaks to it being more like music promotion, concert promotion as an art form, as opposed to a business first kind of model, where like, of course, you'd make a bunch of bands that sound the exact same because that's what the audience would be want to be spoon fed.
It was never really about money for me. It was what I wanted to do. I had a drive to do something completely different, what I liked, and I didn't care what anybody else thought. I was really driven just to continue, whether it was making money or not. I realized it was a business, but it was never treated like a business. Gary and I often talk and say, I don't know how we did it, but I mean, we were booking a lot. But even the movies, like two different movies every night for like 5 years and all night. It was my satisfaction that counted, nobody else's. I wasn't a great businessman. I mean, I could do business to settle shows or whatever and pay taxes, but it wasn't about that for me. It was the art. To me, I felt like I was kind of a creative artist or curator. And that's all that counted.
Well, speaking of how'd you do it, how'd you hear about the Screamers? Because they didn't have any records, like, and you're booking them to headline, and it's like talk about something ahead of your time.
Well, I knew who they were, because you're obviously reading. I mean, people say, how did you hear about those? Well, it's just like a painter reading paint magazines and seeing what the new things are, right? I knew who they were, and I think they approached us, and it happened to be Halloween as well, which was perfect. And that's how it happened. And then, I can't remember who opened other than Drastic Metal. Oh, Cardboard Brains, I think, opened. To Drastic Measures for one were nothing like the Screamers, although there could have been sort of musically some similarities in their minds. But that's how we booked them, and they were unknown. Not too many people showed up.
Were Cardboard Brains kind of doing the synthy thing yet, or is that still around the first single, kind of more punky, straightforward?
Yeah.
Oh, so that, I wonder if that had an impact on him that night, and I wonder if that's what drove him to kind of become that more sort of minimal synth driven.
You know what? One of the few shows that I wasn't at, because my daughter had to go out in for Halloween, and I had to take her, and she wanted to be a bride. So I used my dad's old tuxedo and was the father of the bride. And then she wouldn't even let me come up to trick or treat. I had to stand outside on the sidewalk while she went out and was like freezing cold that night.
The things you do as a parent, I can
I
very
know.
much
So,
relate to that.
yeah, so I wasn't there, unfortunately, but.
But like to know to book them for Halloween without hearing them too, right? Like there would have
Well,
been
I'd
no
heard
way.
of them.
But like you hadn't heard them, right?
But no, they would say they had cassettes.
Oh, I guess they
Like
would have had.
everybody had a garage tape or something.
Okay, yeah, that
Like
makes more sense.
you wouldn't book. I don't think anybody, including me, would book an artist without hearing.
Yeah.
Like, because you just don't know. And, you know, being a promoter, whether it's movie, you know, my situation, either case, whether it's movies or music, and you know, as you know, as a band leader, it's months before the show. All the logistics that go into it, all the promotion, everything, you know, we're doing taxes, we're doing promoting, we're doing tickets, we're doing negotiating. I would never book anything I didn't hear, didn't know, or liked, because it's too much energy. And it's like, there's plenty of bands that we were approached to do that we wouldn't do, because I don't fucking care about them, you know? And I'm not going to waste like 4 months doing it and wondering if I'm going to lose money on something. I don't mind losing money on something I love, but I resent losing money on something I can't stand.
Would you have kept like something like the Screamers tape that they would have sent you?
A lot of stuff was lost. I don't have a lot anymore like that. I lost a ton of stuff in that flood. I had 76 pieces of art that got lost. I could only salvage a few of them. It was insured, luckily, but no, I don't have anything by them.
Would that have been the same with the Misfits? Would they have sent you like some sort of tape, or would they have sent you like the Bullet 7-inch? Because I think the Bullet 7-inch is just coming out around then.
Yeah, I had that, and they were selling that there. I got a bunch of them because I'm a huge Lee Harvey Oswald fan. So that cover was brilliant.
Hopefully they weren't lost in the flood too.
That was lost in the flood too.
I don't mean to keep bringing this up then.
I lost so much.
There's like so
the
many
water,
bands. Like,
water in a container or whatever for like 8 months. Not
destroys.
Drying out. It's brutal.
There were just like other random bands I wanted to ask you about that you guys booked. I just feel like, you know, obviously some of these are touched on in the book, and but some are just like, I think feel like they're kind of lost almost to history a little bit. But the Jumpers looked like they played several shows up here.
Yeah, they would come
from
up.
Buffalo.
They were a great band, and they would come up from Buffalo. We had a lot of fans in Buffalo. In fact, Harvey Weinstein was a big fan of the Roxy. This is when he was Harvey and Corky, the CPI of music promotion in upper, you know, whatever, New York State, Buffalo and that area. And he knew about the Roxy, and I could get tickets to any of his shows because of the Roxy. Once I went to see AC/DC at the hockey arena there, and they were opening for Aerosmith. And when they were on stage, I have a great tape of it. When they were on stage, there was very few people in the arena at that point. And then it was sold out. People started trickling in while they were on. And they played for an hour, and they were amazing. And he gave me seats right in front of the PA, sitting on the floor. And I had bought this Sony little tape deck that when Roxy Music first played in Toronto at Massey Hall, I bought this tape deck at Bay Blue Radio. It cost $250 then in like 1974 or five, and I took it. I have a great tape of them, of AC/DC playing there, and I had a note because I wanted to bring them to Toronto. Nobody really knew who they were, I don't think, and I threw a note onto the stage, and you hear me on the recording, a Bon, because I threw the thing and it reached him on stage. We were front row, and I met him backstage after the show, and he gave me, the contact for his management and all that stuff. They never returned the calls or anything.
When I was in Australia once, I was at a great store there called Vicious Sloth, and they showed me a poster for an AC/DC tour of Australia. It must be around 76. That they say 100% punk rock AC/DC on
Yeah,
the
yeah.
poster for the tour. So, and I guess they played CBGBs and they played LA with
Oh
the
yeah.
Dogs and
Yeah,
stuff.
yeah.
So
Well,
they are not, go on, sorry.
no, go on.
They're another band that I feel like it, certainly in Australia is essential to the punk rock story.
Well, I think that Angus is stripping and throwing his school uniform on the floor and everything and stomping on it is probably more punk rock than any punk rocker has ever performed. Like that is a pretty heavy thing to do, right? The first time the Ramones played at the New Yorker in 76, I played my own music, and I was playing. I on the mix was AC/DC, and a bunch of kids came out and said, "Turn that shit off!" I said, "Fuck you." I mean, they're still like one of the greats of all time.
Absolutely. The other band I wanted to talk about is The Fast, who
The Fast
they
favorite.
kind of, yeah, and they're kind of out, like sort of written out of the history of punk, I
I
feel like, in a
know,
lot
I
of ways.
know.
A great band.
They played here numerous times, from the Edge, and the Horseshoe and different shows. We brought them up to open for different bands, the Music Hall and stuff. They're a great band. And, Paul and Mickey and Louis Bova, just great guy. I'm still, in touch with Louis all the time on Facebook.
What did you make of the hardcore stuff when
And
that
they were
started?
theatric.
Very theatrical.
They were
Great.
theatric as it gets. I mean, Mickey Zone was like genius.
I feel like them and the Mumps too. Mumps are also super theatrical.
Yeah.
It's almost like theatrical punk, the New York
Yeah, I
theatrical
never
punk
had
scene.
them.
Yeah, I wonder, I don't even know how much touring they did outside of like playing shows in New York.
Yeah, I don't know.
What did you kind of think when hardcore started showing up in like Brian Taylor and Youth 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 and that whole wave of kids?
Well, I've been friends with Brian for years, through the record stores and selling tickets and whatever. And I like the hardcore stuff. It started to become a little generic in time, but what I loved really, and it was, I think it was more political than the punk stuff. And 10 years, whatever, 8 years later or something, right? What I did love was the drummers. All these hardcore bands and thrash metal bands, I always thought the drummers were like jazz drummers, and I could sit and stand and watch these drummers like all night long, just fantastic. And I think that the drummers, gave me a deeper appreciation for that genre. I think the speed and all that just was a carry on from punk. But like your band, to me, I think your band is a kind of it's a fucked up pop band.
Yes.
I mean, I listen to the chords are all fucking pop chords, right? And everything else is fucked up.
Well, I think we're influenced by like the whole punk thing, right? From the Nerves to the Screamers to all of it, and just trying to like bring it all in at once. So yeah, like I'm screaming up there, so they have to do something to counterbalance that. So
Yeah,
it's all the
so,
poppy
but
stuff.
they're very, there's tunes there.
Yeah, well, I think we
And in the screaming.
that's what we like. I think Discharge, Jennifer from Royal Trucks described Discharge as being like a band that hid melody within the distortion, and
Yeah,
I feel
yeah.
like that's what we're trying to do too. Add a little, a little bit of melody in there somewhere.
I think when, as I say, when the grunge thing started, which I guess carries into the hardcore and thrashy kind of playing, I got really bored with it. I just thought I'd heard it all before, and it hasn't interested me. And everybody looked the same and acted the same. And I don't think the punk thing and the early hardcore, the early 80 into the early 80s would ever really happen again, honestly. Like, I just think it doesn't have the, there's no emotion to it like it, like the original years of those music forms. You know what I mean?
It's different now because I feel like the relationship to culture has changed, and like what music
Yeah.
was used for has changed so much, right?
Yeah.
Like, and it is such a like cult, it was such an interesting cultural moment that, in the death of the 60s, where you had sort of the cynicism that was brought into music. You had photocopiers and, like you're saying, tape decks that were accessible so people could express themselves. And there was a freedom in that that I think, yeah, you're right. It's just, it won't happen in the same way ever again. Something could happen, like for people now, but it's not going to be the same
I
as it
just don't
was.
think the fans or the audience, potential audiences, excuse me, have the same upbringing that we all did, and they don't understand, and they don't feel like your music and prior to your music, it was really from the heart, and I don't think it's, I think it may be from the heart now, but there's a different motive to it.
Well, I feel like the thing is that there was almost like you did it because you did the thing. Like you're saying, there's not a lot of commercial expectations in booking a band like the Screamers that doesn't have a record out. You're doing it because you want to see it happen.
Yeah.
And I think post social media, everything has currency now. And even putting on a show now, you're like, hey, look at me, I'm doing this thing. Or you're playing in a band like, hey, look at me, I did this thing. And so it's not necessarily like you're doing it because you want to do it. You're doing it, and there's always this expectation of how will this be perceived? Can I monetize this? Is this good for my personal brand? Like it's just changed.
Well, I quit in 1992, just at the time that we're talking about, and the reason was that it all felt the same, and audiences were just starting, new audiences were starting to come in, and they were coming in, and they were standing there, and they were waiting for the band, and that's the way it is, and I can't go to shows anymore. It's just so boring. The whole energy and the whole drive of the bands and the audiences is completely different, almost forced or simulated. Just not interested in it.
One band that I'm obsessed with, and I just wanted, because you probably knew these people before because they were probably coming to the theater to see movies, but the Cur as Curse. And I feel like they're like one of those bands that, unlike the Vileptones and Teenage Head, who are kind of, talked about in sort of like another way, but I feel like maybe it's because they have that one single and that's it. They're not really celebrated in the same sort of
No,
light.
and they should be. I mean, they were, the first or one of the first. I don't know if the B Girls came before the Curse, but both those groups were like historically important for the music and historically important for the being women. Women weren't treated very well in those days as, women musicians. Carolyn Azar and Fifth Column, once told me that she felt like the clubs that we were running were the only safe places for women. You go into some of these other places and they just had to watch their backs, and they weren't really appreciated being there. And so I think, those three bands, Fifth Column and The Curse and the B Girls, very important. But of course, history is always rewritten. Like Liz Wirth's book, it was rewritten probably by Ralph Alfonso.
I feel like anyone that writes a history of punk, other than like a book like yours, where it's like kind of a memoir as the history going into it, is begging for problems because everyone's got their own memories and interpretations of what happened, and people that were there are going to see things very differently than people that have studied it.
Unfortunately, you always forget people. People complain, why am I not in that? There's one guy, Evan Levy, who was like a key guy with the Garys as far as security. He ran our security, organized it and all that for our shows. And he was in the book at one point, and the next thing I look and he's not there. And I didn't even notice that he wasn't there because I knew he was there before, when people get missed out. But he hijacked my brain when Derek asked me about if we were interested in doing it, and Gary wasn't, and I was. I said, I don't want it to be a rock and roll book like the other books. I don't mean rock and roll, you know what I mean? A rock book. I want it to be about the community. That's what I want it to be. And I strove for 2 years with him. Against him, whatever, both to make it that kind of book. And I think it translated because I think the book is resonating with all sorts of people who don't really care about the bands as much as the scene. And I think that scene is that punk scene, from mid 70s to 1980, maybe 81, but more 80, was crucial to the development of this city. And when you look at the 50s and rock and roll, it was a phenomenon, but it didn't change anything in the world. You look at the hippies, it kind of changed things for a while, but just sort of within humans, the love and peace and all that stuff. But it didn't really do that much. You come to punk rock and that DIY ethic, and you see it today. It's still existing. It's still, the Vile Tones are still having an effect on kids today or neighborhoods today. In those days, when kids were starting to learn how to play instruments and forming bands, or not even learning how to play instruments and forming bands, people were opening up restaurants and art galleries and hair salons and designing fashion. And it was at a time when Toronto was changing. It was boring as hell, The worship pages in the Toronto Star were as big as the movie pages in the Toronto Star, places to worship. It was a horrible time. But so the development in Toronto and real estate wise was changing big time. And like Carrie did a movie about Parkdale recently, and you wouldn't have walked in Parkdale in a million years back then, in daylight. It was dangerous. Now it's like trendy or whatever you want to call it. It's artistic. There's arts going on in there, being influenced. And I think that the punk rock scene and the audiences and the bands have maybe totaled 1,000 altogether, affected Toronto, and it happened all over the world. So I really, you know, I wanted to try to make people realize or understand that this just was not a music scene. It was a sociological, what's the word? Uprising,
Upheaval, yeah, upright, yeah, because
upheaval. Yeah, it was incredible what was going on. Queen Street in the days of the Horseshoe, it was like gravel on between the streetcar tracks. There was like warehouses of dry goods. There was the Beverly Tavern that the OCA kids went to, and the Peter Pan had just opened. There was nothing. It wasn't like it is now, you know, kind of destroyed, but I mean, it's a tourist attraction and all that, and it's going to happen. But punk rock, you know, I always tell people you walk by Holt Renfrews or Creed's or Tiffany's, and you see like, you know, 85-year-old women walking out of there in like punk outfits with stiletto heels and pink hair and black, all in black, and you know, study kind of belts. Like in those days, the kids that were wearing studs, you know, the cops were waiting for them when they came out of the clubs.
But
They
the thing
were
of it.
very, very courageous. It was a very courageous and very emotional time for that group of kids who followed and formed this community. And I, you know, even though I was a little older, I felt it because it's exactly how I felt when I was that age. And
What
like
about?
you're a parent, I think. So,
Yes,
you know,
three kids.
I always think like, give my kids the leeway. You have to let them do what they, you know, within reason, what they want to do. But I think, no, I got to let her do that or him that, you know, that's what it's all about.
100%.
So like at the Roxy, I mean, I was like a social worker, you know, because there were kids on drugs and people were, it was an amazing kind of thing to witness, like a community center almost, you know, helping people get through a night, you know, that bad trips or whatever. And, you know, I'm not saying it was a bad place, but, you know, that was the culture. I wanted the book to be called Community Service, but they thought it sounded too much like, a community service.
Outreach book. Yeah. I
Home
feel like
group.
that, well, that maintains throughout punk. It's always been a place for people,
Yeah.
a lot of people who are neurally diverse, to kind of come together and build community and build family,
Yeah. And to
and
let
it's
their emotions out.
absolutely. And that's the thing that I think keeps it happening and keeps it kind of vital, is the fact that it's always going to be a place that a kid can be like, I'm going to put a PA up here. I'm gonna get a bunch of friends that may or may not know how to play
Oh
their
yeah.
instruments to come here and play, and we're gonna have a good time. And I think that's what's so powerful about it. And I think that's the great thing about the book, is that it does reflect the fact that this is a community more than it is a bunch of dudes on stage, you know.
Yeah, I really tried not to make it to steer it away from that kind of book. It's not a memoir. We got all sorts of people to enlarge on what my interview is about, and I think it worked really well. I can't believe like the reaction to it, and the book launch was like you couldn't have had a better bunch of people at a book launch than the people that were actually there. And you know, with the things that I've done and the people that have followed what I've done or followed me through the years, everybody knew each other. And it was the same all through those years. Everybody knew each other. It was like a club.
Yeah. What about Mike Nightmare and the Ugly? And like, there's a lot of stories about them being a gang, that, you know, all these sorts of like sort of legends. How much of that is just the legend, and how much is the reality? Like, were they scary? Was it that, like, was there a lot of violence around that band?
I think there's a lot of truth to some of their personal lives, but no, I mean, I didn't get scared by anybody's, but I mean, to watch him on stage, like one of the, you know, internationally, he would be up there with the great front people of all time, right? And the band was obviously the real deal as far as you know, playing and Persona.
I feel like they're done a disservice by that record being two of their poppier songs versus the stuff that came out later on that CD, where it's a lot more, I think, reflective of kind of the aggression that people said they had on stage.
Yeah, I can't tell you. I mean, you see them a lot, and I don't even think about the records. I just think about what I remember of them and how great they were live and what an effect they had on the audience and what their image was on and off stage. As I say, all those bands in that era, they included, they're all great songs, and you put that single on any mix and it with any music and it stands up.
Who out of all the bands, and I know this is asking a lot, are the band that didn't get recorded, maybe is completely sort of forgotten at this point to you, that's sort of the big, I guess, tragedy that they're not remembered in any sort of way? Because there are so many that didn't record at all.
I can't tell you.
Because,
I can't think of it. Can't think of them all.
yeah, there's a lot to
It's
get through.
kind
You
of
booked a lot of bands.
impossible.
Yeah.
I mean, there were bands that played one gig and never did anything. I can't even remember anything. But I'll tell you, just as a plug, there's a band in Hunt in Sudbury called Lightmares that fits into what that if they were if. No matter they're right now, but they're one of those bands that I think are like tragic, should be playing arenas that are that they are that good.
Yeah, there's definitely a geographical privilege that comes from being in a place like Toronto versus being in a place like Sudbury, where you have access to media or access to, places to get your music out. Labels are here, and there's shows to play here where bands are touring through. Like, you see that a lot throughout punk, where bands in big cities were definitely subject to more opportunities than bands from smaller places.
Look at like Dick Duck and the Dorks, who are basically our crew. You know, it could be 10 people, it could be 20 people on stage, caterers, you know,
Yeah.
everybody.
Yeah.
They were never really recorded. They were one of the greatest live bands of all time in Toronto.
Yeah. Yeah, like that's the thing. It's like, how would you record that though? Like, how would you capture that when
Well,
it
they
was
recorded the new Christy Minstrels. They recorded the Mendelssohn Choir.
Toronto also is a music industry town, and I think you guys
Well,
buck
it
that.
wasn't back then. It was the center.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it a music industry town because the music industry were chicken shit about everything and had their ears and eyes closed and didn't care about anything. I call them the closet queens and didn't come out of the closet till like 1980. Didn't care about anything we were doing. Didn't support artists that we were bringing that might have had a record out, they didn't care. They didn't care. We had somebody from Capitol Records come to the Horseshoe one night, one afternoon rather, because Blondie was playing at the El Macambo. And we asked him, how come Blondie's not playing here? He said, well, they have carpet on the floor, you don't. That was her answer, an A&R person. Like they didn't care. They didn't promote. One time the Ramones were playing, and this is l years later, obviously, but they were playing at RPM. You know, they played RPM a few times for 3-night runs, and one of these runs, they're coming in, and I wanted to get some press going because they're coming, right? They're Ramones, and. Nobody replied to me from Warner Brothers or WEA. So I set up an interview with Now, with Joey, and they sent a photographer to New York to take a shot of Joey in a barber chair and was on the cover the day the run started. And no, the week before the run started, on the Thursday before the week the run started. And I got a call from Warner. How did you do that? Well, how did that happen? Who did you talk to? Blah, blah, blah. I said, we did it on our own. You can't do that. You didn't care, so we did it. This is our show. Fuck off. Like, they never cared.
Yeah, it definitely. I think it was still like that when I was working at Much Music
Yeah,
later
and
on.
that's why all those great bands that should have had deals never got deals, because it was the record center of the country, but they didn't care about any of it. They didn't see anything other than, well, their tour jackets.
Yeah, because the
Know, they
only.
didn't care.
Yeah, because I guess CBS with. Teenage Head, and I guess Attic Records signed a couple. Yeah.
Attic signed a couple. I had a good relationship with Tom Williams at Attic, and he would come down when I told him, you should see this band, they're ready to they should you should do a deal with them or something. And I don't know how the deals ever worked out with the bands and Attic. Some bands say fuck, it was horrible, whatever, I don't know, but they got but all, a lot of those bands should have been signed. The Sharks, who weren't a punk band, they were an international band. Teenage Head were an international band. Drastic Measure should have been signed. I don't know. Vile Tones should have been signed with punk, but they didn't listen. And it wasn't until around, near the end of the Edge. Excuse me, sorry. Veering on the First Police Picnic in 81 is when the record companies started to figure that there's something to all this, and they figured that because it was happening in the States and it was happening in England.
Yeah, I guess there's, a Mad Rush Basement Records kind of era at the end of
Yeah.
that sort of like time to sign some of these bands. But like you're saying, there's no Vile Tones LP. Like
No, I
there's
know, it's
no a lot.
ridiculous. And
Yeah, like
tons of covers.
absolutely. And
Like cover
a lot of
versions.
bootlegs, a lot of bootlegs of the seven inches over the years too. And it's interesting how that kind of shaped, I think, the music in Toronto. Like I think because of that, the next wave of bands are so underground, like the sort of, once again, Brian Taylor, Youth Youth Youth, Direct Action, like a lot of those bands are just doing tapes. Like there's no label interest at all at that point, no management interest in a lot of these bands.
Well, I don't think there would be in Toronto in back then, 40 years ago, just because everything was so straight. And now the industry, I think, is so fucked that there won't be now. But in between, you'd think there should have been interest, because there's tons of tapes coming out of all those bands, from the States, and we were as good, if not better, than most of them.
I think it's a little bit later, I guess, when Fringe starts doing stuff. But by that point, a lot of these bands were a little bit later in their careers, and it's not quite as vital as those tapes were.
And they were doing, they were going for sort of, I guess, a more commercial sound. I mean, they did a good job with what they did. You got to give them credit for doing it. But, Toronto was like shafted just because we were Toronto. We weren't New York.
It's also interesting when you look at something like Vancouver, given the population, how many labels they had, and how many of those bands put out records, just because I guess Quintessence and Friends Records being there, there's a lot more for that scene, given how much smaller it would have been than the Toronto scene, I would imagine.
I think the Vancouver scene really sprouted, but I think they were influenced by the Toronto scene. But they did have a lot of good groups. I've never really been into the West Coast period, north or south. So a lot of them, like for instance, I loved the Paola's first single, China Boys. I mean, they went in a different direction and all that, but when we brought them to the Edge, they couldn't fucking play. And A&M had just signed them and said, what did we sign these guys for? They were living in the off in the upstairs of the club. On the floor they brought was like a hippie caravan with all those people, with their kids and their wives and on their long dresses, their skirts and all that stuff. But DOA had some great singles. I can't even think of them now, but they really sprouted after the Toronto scene happened. And my friend Marv Newland, who lived here, he was the fellow who made Bambi Meets Godzilla. And when he moved to and he's the first he took drove me to the Roxy to see it for the first time and did all this original artwork for the Roxy. When he moved to Vancouver, he was sending me like tape singles all the time from Vancouver bands.
It's so funny because when I was reading about, Bambi Meets Godzilla and your connection to Marv in the book, it hit me like, oh my God. So I called my dad. I'm like, did you know the guy did Bambi Godzilla? And he's like, oh, I knew Marv. Definitely. I'm an animator, of course. So
He knew him personally?
yeah, I met him a few times through a guy, I think, who worked on Yellow Submarine, who lived in Toronto back then and lived in the beaches, he was saying, or he met him through somebody. But my dad was in advertising, so kind of had, little connections. He put Rough Trade in a Pepsi commercial way back when.
Oh yeah.
That was his, I guess, his big Toronto punk rock claim to fame.
Well, Marv, not Marv, his wife worked at, and Carol and Kevin worked at what became Nelvana Films, the animation company. That's how I did Rough Trade's first show at the Roxy. They called and said, can we play at the Roxy? And that was the first electric Rough Trade show they had ever done. But yeah, Marv was originally from California and met a couple of his friends and they did some artwork for me, but yeah, it was pretty inf they were pretty influential.
Another mutual connection that also is a connection to Pat Smear.
What's your father's first name?
Graham.
Graham Abram?
Yeah, he worked for J. Walter Thompson back
Okay.
then. But another mutual connection is the Battered Wives, who I believe the lead singer was a house painter and painted my parents' house when I was a kid, and is also Pat Smear from the Foo Fighters and the Germs' father-in-law.
Really?
So we do have a Battered Wives connection as well as a Bambi
Yeah,
Meets
I was
Godzilla.
never into Battered Wives. To me, they were just a bar band with a sort of a controversial shtick. I just thought they were maybe too theatric for me.
That's that theatric again.
Yeah, that's why I said it.
Did you ever see Bunny and the Lakers? I think that's a pre-Fifth Column band.
I can't
Do
remember.
a show for them? Because like that's,
I can't remember.
I feel like there's I just ask you bands forever based on stuff on the flyers or
I don't
bands from.
remember everything.
Yeah, well, it's hard. There's
I
like a.
did lights for every show and I smoked a lot because I became a great lighting guy. So I tried to remember everything. I mean, now that the book's out, I'm remembering things. Shit, why didn't I talk about the village people at RPM? I was in the hallway at RPM as they were lined up against the wall getting dressed. Was quite an experience. There's things you just don't remember at the time, but Bunny and the Lakers, maybe there's a maybe it's I guess I remember the movie Bunny Lake is Missing.
Yes. Well, Village People had a punk single too, Food Fight.
Food Fight?
Yeah, the Village People. It sounds like the
Yeah, oh
Dickies. So there's a punk connection with them as well,
yeah.
unfortunately, right now. But the there's also this band, the Deafix, that I think showed up on one of your flyers too from Detroit. Like there seems like there was a lot of Detroit crossover
Well, they were
around that.
close. They were close. Destroy All Monsters are I totally remember. We booked them opening for Suicide with Teenage Hit in the middle. And they were great.
Did you have any connection with them through the film stuff prior to? Because I know they were doing sort of artistic, like art films, I guess, prior to. And Kim Gordon had some connection to that, and they had an OCAD connection, I think, even.
Yeah, I don't know. They called and wanted to play, and they were going to be around, could have been around When Suicide were coming, I thought it was a mighty good double bill,
Oh, yeah.
triple bill. As it turned out, nobody liked them. Nobody liked Suicide. Everybody came for Teenage Head. Most people left after Teenage Head. The ones that were there hated Suicide, which was, one of the one of those like top 10 shows of all time.
Who is your all-time favorite that you've gotten to do?
My all-time favorite show? Is that
Yeah.
what you?
Or band, or like, yeah, band you brought in or got to promote for you.
Oh, that's a really hard question. I mean, I couldn't even answer it. I mean, Suicide was one of my very favorite shows. Ramones were one of my very favorite shows. An Australian bandoneon accordion player named Astor Piazzolla was one of my favorite shows. Fetching Bones, South sort of punky band around a singer, was one of my favorite female vocalists. It's hard to say which are my favorite. There's not too many that weren't.
Who was the worst for you then?
Knack, easy to say, the Knack. And that was done as a favor, and they were horrible. I mean, the record was just new. My Sharona was just new, but they came in with all these big Marshall stacks and stuff, and the first show, they blew them up. They were so loud. They were terrible. They were just awful. But I never liked LA bands, or punk
Well,
bands, or I just didn't like LA. I mean, I feel bad for, I love LA, the city, but I didn't like the music. I thought it was all, had nothing close to the Toronto bands or like the New York bands. It was all even kind of copying the Vancouver bands to me. They were like fourth-rate bands, most of them, of that era.
even the nerves. And stuff like that.
Well, there were some, but I didn't. Most I didn't like, and I didn't like the business practice of LA. It was just wasn't what I was into.
Well, Gary, this has been way closer to the screamers than the knack, I promise you. And
Well,
anytime you want to come back on here and talk about any of this stuff, the door is always open.
thank you. Call me anytime.
There's been progress from that. That's great. I'm in terms of, sexuality. I mean, I think the world is a different place. I fear that the world is becoming yet another different place. So I'm very sad about that. And, I don't know. I don't want to be the old, I don't want to be like the old gay guy that just bitches about all my friends are dead. But there's cautionary tales, and in this day and age, get off the screen, get out of the house, please protest in person, and then you'll end up in on social media.
Well, anytime you want to come on here and talk about protests, wrestling, punk, Bob, whatever, you are always welcome.
Damien, it's always great to talk with you. I love telling stories with you. It's so much fun. Thank you for having me.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.